Wake up now. All right, we are back on the record. Mr. Norell, you can proceed with your witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. I call Mike Diller to the stand.
Mr. Diller, I'm required to advise you that the penalty for perjury in North Dakota is a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $5,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Norell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Diller, could you please state your name and business address for the record?
Mike Diller. I work for the Public Service Commission in the state capitol.
In Bismarck, North Dakota?
In Bismarck, North Dakota.
And you said you were employed by the North Dakota Public Service Commission. Could you please describe your position?
I'm a director of economic regulation. I've testified in many hearings over the years. I've worked for the commission since 1987.
And you have before you a document what's been marked Exhibit PSC 1. Could you please describe for the commission what that is?
That would be my direct testimony.
And if I asked you all the questions today as they appeared, and that would any of your answers change?
They would not change.
Your Honor, I would offer PSC Exhibit 1 to the record.
Any objection?
No objection.
PSC Exhibit Number 1 is admitted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Diller, in front of you is a black three-ring binder opened up to, I believe, MDU Exhibit 5. Could you describe what MDU Exhibit 5 is again for the record?
This is the settlement agreement that we've been talking about.
And on page 8, is that your signature?
It is.
Could you please describe briefly from your standpoint as a ratepayer advocate what the settlement means for North Dakota ratepayers?
Well, I think that's outlined a little bit in my settlement, but in my pre-filed testimony. But, one of the biggest things, and I talk about it for a page or two in my testimony, is that we're capturing the potential over-earnings that may occur in 2014 through a settlement agreement. Outside a settlement agreement, you wouldn't have that opportunity. And so there is a real chance for a benefit to ratepayers in that regard. If we're talking about benefits, which we've been doing for quite some time now, one of the big benefits is that the customers have an 88-megawatt gas turbine sitting over there when they need it. And so that's a big benefit. When it's 100 degrees and hot and muggy and you need that thing to cool your house, it's a big benefit. Other benefits I think have already been talked about, but another big benefit is that I believe if just a simple rate case was filed, as was talked just a few minutes ago, we would probably use a weather normalized sales volume, and again we would not capture those elevated sales levels in 2014. It'd be projected on, let's say, a 2015 test year. And I think there's quite a few benefits here for customers.
There was a question that had been asked of Mr. Sanger earlier that I'd like to ask you, and that would be, there's been a lot of discussion about the volumetric charge versus the fixed.
Right.
And if the commission rejected that portion of the settlement, I believe the question asked Mr. Sanger was, would that be a deal breaker? What would your answer be to that question?
You know, I hate questions like that, respectfully to Alana, because I hear that and I think, well, this is better, but could you live with something that's not so good? I'm not really in any position to say whether it's a deal breaker or not. I just try to represent the interests of the ratepayers. So to say whether that's a deal breaker for ratepayers or not, they generally speaking, they're not going to understand it, let alone care whether it's a fixed charge or an energy charge, I guess. So that's about as good as I can answer it.
Okay. That's fine. I have no further questions, John.
Mr. Koontz?
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Okay, Mike, so tell us, I know you filed testimony, but just tell us generally again here why it's a better deal to have that fixed, the recovery and the fixed charge.
You know,
why,
look, I was scribbling on some. If I can't find my scribble notes, I'll just have to do it. There we go. sure. I guess I would start from a very, very base level, a holistic approach, if you will, and then we'll work into the details. On the very base level, I would say just common sense dictates this, that we consider a fixed charge in this matter, and I'll explain it a little bit. But, think about the big argument is about residential customers, right? We've got demand charges for the general service class, and it's a demand cost. We've all agreed to that, and we understand that. And so, of course, it should be on a demand. If it's a demand cost, it ought to be billed on a demand on the bill as a demand charge. So we're really just talking about residential customers and maybe some very small general service customers that maybe don't have a demand meter. And just the basic instinct in me says, really, $10.50 a month and I can have access to the electric grid? $10.50 is what we pay right now. Of course, I don't. I'm a Moore Grand Sioux customer, so my fixed charge is $35. And then in addition to that, there's a $10 storm damage that we've been paying for the last 2 to 3 years. So actually, my fixed price where I live is $45. MDUs is $10.50. My cell phone, I didn't bring it in here, that's $75, whether I use it or not. You can go down all of the services that we as people use, whether it's cable TV or, the water bill, internet service, even golf, for Pete's sake. I mean, you pay a fixed price for that service, and it might cost me more on a per-stroke basis than it does Dan Koontz. And so is that fair? Well, there is some socialization in everything we do, including golf. And so that's a very, common sense analysis. Now they start getting into a little more detail. In the last rate case, the first thing I did when I saw this thing was this. I thought immediately, this can't be a variable charge. It's a unit that's sitting over there, seldom used, and it's for the express purpose of running when you need it the most. It's just sitting there. The costs are all fixed, and so it should be a fixed cost. So anyway, I went to the, and I happen to have it here with me, the last rate case class cost of service study. And then I went to my witness, Steve Goodner's testimony, and he said that MDU's class cost of service study, he said, provides a reasonable standard for developing rates. And so based on the testimony of the last rate case, the customer charge should be $16.40 for electric consumers. We pay 10.5 today. Right there I'm going, okay, so there's room for a fixed charge there. And for commissioners and everybody else in the room, class cost of service studies don't change that much from 1 year to the next. And so you can depend on this to a large degree. Yes, it'd change a little bit if we updated it for 2014 costs, but the allocation of costs wouldn't be too much different. And so that was part of my reasoning. Then the one that just kind of grates on me or bothers me a little bit is just the pricing of services. You really want to try to price services based on cost. And anytime you get prices that are away from cost, then you have a misallocation of resources. And a real easy example would be wind, wind towers or wind farms. We certainly wouldn't have the wind farms that we have today if it wasn't for the federal government subsidy of wind farms. And so you distort, you really, And so then we allocate resources based on a faulty price signal. It's no different for anything. It's like economics 101. Anytime that your price doesn't reflect cost, it gives opportunity for something else to replace that, and perhaps more inefficiently. And so I think it's very important, more important than is it a deal breaker? I think it's more important from a global perspective, a bigger perspective, to try and get prices nearer cost. Now, as far as the last thing I've got scribbled down here, and then I'll just take questions. But, you know, if you think about we're concerned about the residential demand charges, right? And they don't have a demand meter. And so, which is better to put it on? Is it better to put it on the customer charge or the energy charge? Because we can't run out and put a demand meter in for everyone. And so which is better? And if you think about residential customers, at least in my instance, I can tell you when my high peak is every week. Saturday morning, I have a bunch of laundry that needs done. I've got dishes that have not that I'm a pig, but have piled up a little bit. And so I'm running the dishwasher, the washer, the dryer, the vacuum cleaner. Saturday morning's kind of my day to catch up a little bit. And that's when TV's on, listening to Pandora, all that's so. Since mine occurs regularly, and I suspect it occurs regularly for a lot of other people in the room and residential customer classes as a whole, if I had a demand meter, it would go over on Saturday morning, and then it would stick right there. And maybe next Saturday morning I'd also add in car washing with the power washer, and I might push the demand meter over just a little bit further. But for the most part, my bill would be fixed because I use that on that morning. That's when I'm busy working and doing my stuff. And so to me, it makes more. It's a fixed cost unit. It's sitting there. It ought to be a fixed price to customers. If I had a demand meter, it'd be more or less fixed because you could just count on it. Mike Diller's doing those things on Saturday morning, and that's where the meter is stuck until they read it the next month. So there's my reasons, my rationale.
Thank you. In your mind, is there anything inconsistent with any commission precedent for other generation riders? And if there is, anything inconsistent in the settlement proposal? And if there is there any good reason for it?
Right. I don't think we ever do things just be one way because we just always done them before. We live in a dynamic business. It's dynamic for MDU out in the oil patch. It's dynamic for this commission dealing with oil patch or even regulatory ideas and theories and ways to do things. For instance, I brought up in my testimony, and commissioners will probably get to this, so I might as well talk about it now. I've changed a little bit, of course, here in this proceeding, in that I'm starting to realize that riders are taking the place of rate cases. And so, if we just continue to approve riders, we may never have a rate case. We may never have the opportunity to really evaluate a company's business from a global perspective. And so that's why we have a settlement again. It provides me with an opportunity to look at earnings each year. And we don't want to get in the business of approving a $5 million rider if MDU only needs a $3 million rider. So that's a change, a big change, and it's going to have implications on other companies that I regulate, assuming that this settlement is adopted. I'm sorry, what was, I got sidetracked there a little bit.
Well, I had just asked if there were some differences, as you just mentioned, the good reasons why you were promoting this, and you just answered that, so.
Yeah, I think you have to look at each and every filing separately and then try to make the best sense of it as you can. You know, AQCS was mentioned earlier. That's a very big coal plant. It serves capacity and provide, but it's really there for energy, just a constant generator of energy. Makes more sense to me to charge that on an energy basis than something that's sitting there waiting for that 1 or 2, 3, 5 days a year that we really need it.
My final question, do you agree with Ms. Aberle that the fuel adjustment rules as they exist today are adequate to handle what you're contemplating for the cost of the gas pipeline?
I just have to admit that I didn't think that much about the fuel clause adjustment. I agreed in principle. My understanding, I can lay it out here in case it's different from the companies and they can then get up and rebut me, but my understanding is generally, at the end of the day, it's more or less going to be as though the electric side of the business still owns the gas line. We're going to pay a fee to use it, and then we're going to get credit for any benefits that other people get from it, including the natural gas side of their business. And so, to me, I didn't look at it that hard because I thought, it can't get any better than that. It's certainly better than if we just left it on the electric side and didn't use it for any other purpose. And so, to be frank, I didn't really get into rate 58, I think you mentioned. Yeah.
But you're aware that there is a provision for waiver of the fuel rules if appropriate and necessary?
Right. I assume that we'll take care of that when the time comes.
Okay, so. That's all I have. Thanks.
Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Well, as you suspected, I did want to talk some about the whole rate case versus rider issue. And you've sort of covered that, but I want to dig a little deeper. I haven't been at this that long, and it feels like we're going quickly down a path of adding riders, and not ever taking the full look at the rate case. Or I can see that pattern, and I'm not even attached to the rate case process. So you've been doing this for a number of decades. more than one, two, almost three.
Yeah.
So that's good. You have a lot of perspective to add here. And you seem comfortable with this as kind of the new way. Did I understand you correctly to say that one of the reasons why you like the rider is it gives you a chance to look at the earnings every year?
That's true. And one thing that I made clear to MDU while we were working on this settlement agreement was, look, I'm not asking to do this on every rider that you have. That's not necessary, but it needs to be done on one rider, and so that we know that earnings are within a reasonable, you know, ballpark area. And so I'm not suggesting you do this on every rider, but I've chosen, this is the last one that's been filed. It's a good place to start.
So that's part of the rider language, that you get to review the earnings?
Part of the settlement agreement.
So I only see that it provides a mechanism for 2014 that if they're over-earning, then 50% is returned to customers.
Right.
But the next year, say 2015, they apply for recovery through the tariff, and they apply for their whatever they need. What's the mechanism there for reviewing the earnings and sharing with customers? Is there one?
Right. Yes, it's very specific in the settlement agreement, but essentially MDU has committed to staff in this settlement agreement that they will keep us more informed of changes in their business. Not just Mike, costs went up, we're filing, but when things begin to shift and change and it looks like maybe we need to file for a rider, they are to bring us into the process so that we see what they're seeing, we see their evaluations, their assumptions, we see proof of what they're talking about. And beyond that, the settlement provides that we will have an opportunity to look at investments, current investments, future investments, operating expenses. They mentioned changes in taxes, all of those things. And so I just want to make sure staff is not suggesting that we do that kind of an expansive review on all the riders. One is enough because we're going to look at earnings in total. And so, as I talk, I kind of wonder if MDU is sitting over there going, maybe a rate case would have been easier than what Mike's talking about. But I actually think cooperation is always cooperation between the commission and the company, staff and the company. The more staff knows, I think the better the results are for everyone. And if it doesn't work, we can get rid of riders and we can go back to rate cases, or the commission can.
Can you pull out in the settlement agreement what you just described, that language?
Okay. I think you can start on the bottom of page 3, rate adjustment under the generation rider, and specifically maybe, let's see. No, that's not it.
So there's language there that I just want to understand. Montana, it's the second sentence on the top of page 4. Montana Dakota may refile the rate adjustment upon a reasonable showing that the combination of its current projected earnings for the year expected to be below a return level of 10.75% ROE. So that's any year, not just 2014,
right.
Any time,
right.
Correct?
Right.
So then in that, they'd have to provide some information for you where you'd be evaluating their return.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm not seeing it right off hand.
Paragraph 6.
On page.
Annual filing.
Okay. The company will file with the commission a recalculation of the rate adjustment based on annual revenue requirements stated in paragraph 3, projected sales. The filing is to be coordinated with the company's annual reports to the commission, so earnings levels are considered each year prior to authorizing new or modified rate adjustments under the generation rider.
Okay, so just explain that to me.
Okay, sure. Each year the company files an annual report with the commission around April, May, and it basically shows us a full year's worth of operations and how much money they made. We just received their 2013 annual report not too long ago. And so that's a starting place for evaluating the financial condition of MDU. I, of course, keep track of that over the years, so I have 20 years worth of data from year to year to year. So the value of that is you can start to kind of see some normal trends and things of expenses and revenues and sales volumes and all that. But again, that's part of the reason we settled is I don't know what the new normal is anymore. The trends are, you know, for the first 20 years that I was here, MDU would jump up and down and holler if they had customer growth above 1%. Then in 2010, everything changed. 10 and 11, they had 2.5% growth both years, and then the next year, 5% growth in customers. And so everything's changing, and it's awfully hard to...
So how will the filing, their filing annually, combined with that annual report, how will it explain how this mechanism works then?
Okay, so... So by delaying the implementation of this, I will have more history to work with, right? So I'll be able to perhaps get another year's worth of data to work with. But how will it work specifically? Mm-hmm. In here is a very tight timeline, and I think it's almost undoable. But a 30-day timeline in here. But I agreed to it because of their commitment to keep me informed of the financial condition of their company. MDU has monthly financial statements, unlike Xcel Energy, and we fixed that in our last settlement agreement. But they have monthly financial statements for their business on a North Dakota basis. So that's available to me, and so the point of that 30 days is they're supposed to bring me along with them as they run into situations. Wait a minute, the example we've been using is, wait a minute, the summer's cooler than normal, and we're not going to make earnings levels unless we apply for this rider. It could be a number of things, but...
So you'll look at the earnings levels every year, and then... make a recommendation whether the rider is approved or not.
Right.
And then we will approve it or not approve it.
Yeah. My vision of how it's going to work is there will be some negotiations every year.
Okay.
Just on this one. The rest of the riders, we're just going
right.
to let them go. We're not going to get involved in any kind of deep analysis. But each year there's going to be some negotiations occurring until we have a rate case and everything is placed into base rates.
And then number seven here, if they don't file for the tariff this year, will number seven trigger? If they don't ask for the tariff this year, if they decide they don't need it.
We still have a sharing agreement in effect with the settlement agreement for 2014.
Okay, so that's not based on them.
Nope.
Well, they wouldn't need it then. They wouldn't need it.
We'll get the 2014 results in March or April, May of 2015, and then if there is an overearning situation, then we'll deal with it.
Okay. Let's see. Back to your testimony. On their authorized rate of return of 10.75%, you spend a fair amount of time talking about whether or not that's too much in your testimony. You provided a little, some justification for why it should be higher for the electric versus gas. But is that... You know, without rate cases, you don't get a chance to relook at that and authorize a different one. Is that one of the big reasons not to support this? Or how does that fall in?
It certainly would be if you didn't have that 2014 sharing agreement in place. I mean, quite frankly, that's 10.75 was last authorized, and it's a little high. I say that in my testimony, but... We're, you know, it's a negotiated settlement agreement, and there's some give and take in settlement agreements. I thought it was I thought I was willing to go to 10.75 to capture any over-earnings in 2014.
So then moving forward in 2015, we don't have that same kind of mechanism?
We don't, but also they don't have a rider in effect right now. It's zero. And so we will, I mean, that's going to affect that's going to affect earnings. Mm-hmm. I mean, $5 million taken out off the table, you know, is a big chunk of change. And so that's the whole purpose of the settlement agreement is, I think, at least from my perspective, and I think from MDU's too, they've been over-earning quite a bit for the last 3, 4, 5 years. And so they know they can't keep doing that. And we expect that they don't keep doing that, that, you know. And so this is the beginning of reaching a more stable, as stable of earnings as we can and a reasonable level given the economic boom that's occurring. I mean, it's a tough time to forecast. It's a tough time to predict, and hence, again, the settlement.
Now, saying that they've been earning, over-earning for a number of years now, and they know it, and should we be tackling that more seriously now?
Well, this is pretty serious. This is, I mean, they're installing a $75 million asset, and we're not giving them higher rates. So I think based on the work that I've done, again, it's difficult to predict right now, but it seems to me like their earnings will be around 10 to 11 without any additional recoveries for this Heskett 3 plant. Mm-hmm. So it is it's MDU's, it's our attempt to, you know, to handle this.
What will be our next opportunity for, likely opportunity for addressing the earnings issue?
A year from now.
With the
2014 results will be out.
Okay, so the earnings sharing.
But well, earnings sharing, but also, I mean, it will just give us another year to evaluate where are they. Did in fact they come in around 10% earnings or not? If they didn't, then we.
Okay. All right. Do you have any other just general concerns or reasons to support a generation rider? Like, do you just think that generation riders are a good idea?
Well, I mean, there's probably some benefits to rate cases, and there's some benefits to riders. You know, you think about what is our role? What is your role as commissioners, and basically your role with MDU is to provide, to be a surrogate for competition, right? That is your role, because they're a monopoly service provider. I don't think by taking pieces like here we're talking about taking Heskett 3, you know, out, we're going to give them full recovery of something that we've told them was prudent to invest in. I don't think just taking that one big piece out of base rates diminishes, I guess it might diminish their efforts to be efficient, but they've got so many other things that they have to cover, increased wages, fringe benefits, and increased, well, they've got 40 more people on staff this year compared to last year. 40 people. I mean, think about the cost of that. So there's, but on the other side, which we're having, all of us are having trouble predicting, is how much additional sales are we going to get? Maybe all those additional sales out in the Bakken or well, Bismarck, everywhere. Their region's growing everywhere. Will that cover all of those additional employees? You know, look at the commission. We are hiring temporary employees. We are hiring outside services because of the workload that we have. They're doing the same thing. And so they've got a lot of new outside service costs that they haven't had in the past. So there's just tons of things that they're faced with, that they have to control costs and manage their business efficiently. Just because we pull out this piece and the AQCS and the transmission rider to cover MISO costs, those are costs that they're incurring. They're just we're just guaranteeing, essentially, kind of not, but we're taking that off the table. There's still plenty of other costs that they have to work at managing.
So then my last question on this, and then I have one other question, I'll be done. So what do you say to the customer who says, well, that's fine, they've got, it's a dynamic time, they have increased costs, but you also, it's sort of fortunate for them that they happened upon these times and have a pretty high ROE, so they're allowed to earn more already. And you're not taking advantage of opportunities to reset that. What do we say to customers who just think that they get to, and one of the costs that they don't have control is they get to earn too much. They get to earn more than what others are, or that they, you know, that's part of their, gets passed along to customers.
Can you help me, Ryan? Because I think I'm just tired. If you could, maybe you could.
It happens. People do get tired of me.
No.
Could you not the first. You and my husband could have some good talks.
just try me one more time.
Okay. So, what do we say to customers who say they're in? They do have all these reasons to try to control costs,
right,
but they have too high of an authorized ROE. They're allowed to earn too much.
Okay.
So if we had a lower ROE, they'd have to control them even more, right?
That's true.
No. Charging less would be one way of doing that. And so what do we say to customers in that situation?
Well, a lot of times customers get confused about MDU resources earnings versus MDU gas or MDU electric, and that's unfortunate. It's kind of unavoidable. But I think you've hit upon one of the benefits of, you know, a full-blown rate case is you do hire economists to come in and tell you what the ROE should be based on their own assumptions and based on there's several different methods, so it's not exactly a science. But, yeah, we don't have that here. And, again, I've advocated accepting this at 10.75 just because I was worried about 2014 earnings.
All right. Then the final, and this is on a different subject, but you talked about the energy charge versus customer, and I understand where you came from, and it seems logical. But why wasn't this the way it's been treated in the past, then, if this is the way to do it, energy
probably
versus
Jerry
customer?
Lean.
Oh, it's Jerry's fault. God,
Jerry. I mean, we're ever evolving in in the way we regulate and the way we think, and maybe it takes something unusual like this one. This was a little different than I'm trying to think, do we have a generation rider with XL or Otter Tail? No, we don't. And so it does cause you to maybe not do the, just go through the motions like you voiced on them, and you go, that does not seem like that should be an energy charge.
Okay.
And so then that leads you to discussions with the people you're negotiating with, and they're smarter about this than I am, and they agreed fairly easily with me right up front, and so often
okay.
we go.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mike.
Yeah.
Commissioner Kolk?
No, Your Honor. I have any questions for Mike, but if it's okay with him, I wanted to get Tammy back up here and a few more questions for her about the settlement agreement based on Mike's testimony, if that's all right. Whenever that time comes.
You recall her.
But thank you, Mike. No, I don't have any. Julie took care of it enough.
I tell you, she did.
Mr. Norrell?
Yes, I think.
I don't. I'm just wondering if Mr. Coons had any cross-examination as well.
I have a few questions for Mr. Diller in light of the conversation just come up. Mr. Diller, there was discussion about the ROE, and I think you said in your testimony and also in answer to Commissioner Fedorchuk's questions that 10.75 is probably on the high end of what you think it might be a reasonable range of a return on equity. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But in your testimony, you referred to the fact or compared it to the 10% return on equity that was recently approved for Montana Dakota's gas operations. Would you not? Did you not?
Yes.
And would you agree, though, that electric operations would probably be considered riskier from a standpoint of an equity cost than gas?
Yes.
So we're recognizing that the 10 was approved for gas. Electric's a little riskier, so somewhere, it would be probably above that. And then you also mentioned, you referenced NSP's electric range of operations, 9.75 to 10 and a quarter for NSP, correct?
Correct.
As another comparable.
Yes.
And would you agree that economists would probably find MDU more risky in terms of equity costs than NSP as a smaller company?
I don't know.
Okay. So I guess the point of my question, Mr. Diller, is that we're talking a pretty narrow range here, somewhere between that 10 and 10.75, in terms of whether that's too high or not. Would you agree?
I would agree, and maybe I could even, subject to check, but I could maybe put a finer point on it. I think the last time I looked at the public utility fortnightly, it seemed like the returns authorized electric companies versus gas companies was in that 0.3 to 0.4% range, higher than average for gas. So that gives you a little more to go on.
So would you agree with me, Mr. Diller, that although the 10.75 might seem to be a little bit on the high end, it still doesn't strike you as being outside of the range of something reasonable either?
No.
And then there were some questions about other generation riders. In a way, for example, if Montana Dakota Utilities, Xcel, Otter Tail, purchases power through a purchase power agreement, whether that be capacity or energy, that's flowed through a fuel adjustment clause, isn't it?
It is.
And in a way, isn't this generation rider almost similar to a fuel adjustment clause and how it treats it? I mean, if this Montana Dakota were buying this capacity from a third party, this Heskett 3, if somebody else, third party, had built that and MDU was purchasing it, it would flow through the fuel adjustment clause.
No, this settlement is better.
Okay.
Because it gives us an opportunity to pull it back if we need to.
And but, I mean, the idea, though, that it's over and above, it's separate from a general rate case.
Right.
It's flowing through. So from that standpoint, it's separate from a general rate case. So would you agree it's not that dissimilar from how other generation resources might be purchased outside or paid for outside of a general rate case?
I'll give you that.
I have no further questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Well, that last discussion just prompted a Jerry question to asking to clarify if you know whether demand charges are recovered in fuel adjustments.
Whether demand charges are recovered? Well, at one time they weren't. I can remember a time when they weren't. I would have to check, but I think that we changed and we do include demand charges in the fuel clause adjustment.
Okay, well, maybe you could check and send an email and it could be part of the record. Would that be okay with everybody? Or we can ask Tammy when she comes back. She'll know for sure.
Sure.
And I just thought the record, to make the record a little clearer, because we've had a couple people say, we don't have any other generation riders. Well, we do have wind riders, or we did. I mean, they may have been expiring, which is generation. Can you tell me if there's a difference in how those costs were recovered, this volumetric versus fixed, in the wind riders, or if you recall?
Whether we talked about?
We didn't talk about it. We talked about not having
a
So the recovery of the costs in something like the wind riders, is that consistent or different from the proposal here in recovering it through a fixed charge?
It would be different.
And is there a reason for the difference?
Well,
or is it?
Yeah, I mean, wind energy isn't anything like a peaking turbine. This one you can turn on and off and demand when demand requires it. Wind blows when it blows, and so it made more sense to be allocated or charged out on a kilowatt-hour basis.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
That's it.
Commissioner Fedorchak? Commissioner Kolk? Hey, Mr. Neurel?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Diller. You can step down.
Thank you.
Mr. Kuntz, are you going to recall Ms.
Aberle?
Ms.
Aberle.
5 minutes, right? We've had Mr. Diller testify in front of us before.
Mr. Kuntz, did you have any initial questions?
Just one follow-up, and before I turn Ms. Aberle over for further cross-examination. Ms. Aberle, in response to some of the prior questions, are you aware of whether there are capacity costs that Montana Dakota incurs or flow through the fuel adjustment clause?
Montana Dakota does pass through costs under a capacity purchase agreement through the fuel cost.
That's all.
Okay. Mr. Norell, anything?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchak? And Commissioner Kolk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Tammy, for coming back up. I got so involved in the questions about your testimony, I forgot my questions about the settlement agreement to you. I just want to make sure I'm perfectly clear on what I think the settlement agreement includes or doesn't include from your perspective. So when we walk through the initial part of the settlement agreement, page 3 talks about the initial cost for the average customer, $362, and then later on that was downward pressure, if you will, to $257 once the pipeline was removed for the average customer, correct?
Correct.
So would it be fair to just assume that that difference from $362, $257, $1.05 would then just shift over to the gas customers?
Essentially, without any credit, yes.
Gotcha, okay. And then when would that, and then later on, well, let's stay on page 3 for now. In page 3, Generation Resource Recovery Rider, third sentence, mechanism to recover the cost of large generation resources. How does MDU classify large generation resources?
I don't know that I have a specific definition for large.
I'd like you to give me something on is large.
88 megawatt turbine.
Would a 500 megawatt plant be large?
It would.
So this could apply to anything then, right?
I would say that the tariff would provide for it, but that any additional resource that we would ask to recover through this rider would come before the commission.
Okay, so that's
so. I mean that's specific. If it was even a smaller turbine, if you will, or smaller generating resource, if we were to want to include that under this rider, that would need to come before the commission.
Okay, fair enough. And then and thank you for putting that out there, Tammy. And then in page 4, part 3, revenue requirement, you feel pretty comfortable with your annual revenue requirement is roughly $5 million a year, correct?
Correct.
And so when would that cost of $257 for the average customer potentially start for an average MDU customer? When do you envision that would start?
Well, as we've discussed here, we're going to monitor our returns. I mean, we have some significant investments projected for 2014 and into 2015, capital investments. So we're going to monitor that along with, as Mr. Singer mentioned, the weather. So we won't start this adjustment mechanism until we come back and provide information to staff and support us that it makes sense for us to actually start charging the amount. So that would be
but
that
what type
30
of notice should you think the public should have of this?
Well, I think that is part of the purpose of the settlement. I think you asked why not just bag the whole thing and come back later, and is because then we could move forward. I mean, if commission staff's gone through the cost, they agree the $5.27 million is appropriate revenue requirement. We're really looking at fewer items, if you will. We're really
I'm tracking there, but at some point in time, whether it's September of 2014 or January of 2015, that'll be a cost that the customers are going to incur. Let's just say for just sake of discussion. But how should the public be told when that's going to start?
Oh, we would insert. We would do a customer insert. We have advised them that we filed for this.
Right.
So we would do an insert. I would propose at the time that we put the adjustment into place so that they knew they'll see a new line item on their bill. And again, we've inserted.
You said the customers have been told about this. What were they? Were the customers told that you'd filed for a request increase of $364? What exactly were the customers told in the bill inserts?
The inserts were based on the original filing. So much would have been the higher value.
Okay.
Higher dollar value.
Fair enough. And then there has been some discussion about the customers will be recouping some money on this thing, and that's a good point that Mr. Diller made. What dollar amount is that right now? Because that I couldn't find that anywhere.
What we're really going to, as the year unfolds, we'll know more about that. And so when by no later than April 15th, we're required to report our returns. But as we've noted, we'll be in discussion and with staff with regard to what those return levels are. So we would know for certain in the early part of next year if there were earnings that would cause this earnings sharing mechanism to kick in.
Okay, but I understood the point that this is a guarantee that customers will get back something because of the over-earnings to this point.
We haven't. This would be on an annual 2014 basis. And
so it's no guarantee that customers are going to get something back?
The only guarantee is that we'll review it. Okay, and if there is any earnings over 1075, the sharing mechanism would go into place.
Okay, but that contradicts Mr. Deller's testimony that basically said the customers are going to get some money back in this thing.
He's looking at a hot summer. I'm not sure.
I
think
a big point.
My understanding
of get money back or they don't. You have to have I can't go out and say this is a good deal for consumers because they're going to get money back unless we know they're going to get money back.
Well, we wouldn't agree to that until we knew what we were going to earn in 2014. If our investments far exceeded what customers came
on.
I believe that what Mr. Diller, my understanding of that line of questioning was, would this mechanism be in place irregardless of whether we put in an amount under the rider? And that is true. So maybe you and I aren't communicating.
So if
we said our earnings are sufficient, we're not going to put into place an adjustment mechanism under the rider. So this $3.06 we would not put that into place. We will still do the review of 2014 earnings, and if there is an amount above 1075, the earnings sharing will take place.
But would you say the biggest benefit to consumers is the fact that the PSC is able to review all this, not necessarily the fact that there might be money coming back?
Yes, because they're not going to see an increase, and they potentially may see a credit on their bill. But we're not going to put the rider in, and irregardless of what our earnings are, so it provides that protection for customers.
I'm just trying to figure out a way that, I think I like this idea we're trying to go through. I'm just got a lot of concerns about how to package it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of uncertainty. You're telling people we approve it, but we don't know exactly what it might be and what the customer impact to you might be. But we'll know in January of 15, even though we're going to approve it in June of 14.
At this point, really, you've approved. If approved, the settlement's approved. Two things are approved: the mechanism to put into place a rider and a sharing mechanism. So those are the two things that come immediately with the settlement. Whether we actually put an adjustment amount in or not, we would see as time goes on, and we would have to file a compliance tariff. We'd have to put those dollar values on the tariff. And at that point, then customers would know, I am now going to start paying for that turbine, and this is the amount I'm going to pay.
Right. Okay. I think that was it. Thank you.
Mr. Koontz?
No.
Mr. Norrell?
No.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
One based on the last conversation. Paragraph 2 of the settlement, as I understand it, and I'm at the top of page 4, if you decide that you need to recover rates under the rider, recover costs under the rider, you will file for those and make a reasonable showing. I'm like 4 lines down from the top of page 4, reasonable showing that the combination of current and projected earnings are expected to be below your return, your authorized return.
That is correct.
Okay. In my mind, I want to know if this is your understanding, but in my understanding, in my mind, that is the company has a burden to show that the rider and the numbers that you want in the rider are reasonable. And that is where the staff, I mean, you'll be working with staff before that, but the staff could say, no, 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 we disagree. And that'll be a commission decision. Is that your understanding?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. So whenever there is a rate, an amount asked from a customer, it will be after you making a factual showing, staff having factual input, and commission deciding.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak, anything further?
No.
Commissioner Kalk?
No, just thank you, Lana, for that follow-up. That kind of answers the better way of phrasing what I was trying to get to. Thank you. Thank you, Tammy.
Mr. Koontz, anything else?
Nothing further.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Aberle. Mr. Norrell, any further witnesses?
No, Your Honor. That would conclude advocacy staff's presentation.
Okay. Mr. Koontz, do you have a closing statement you'd like to make?
Thank you, Your Honor. I do this on the fly. I don't have anything prepared. But for the fact that we had an extremely cold winter, that our sales were well above what we projected, we would need a rate increase. This is a significant investment for this company. And whether that's a 10.75 or 10% or whatever, we would need a rate increase. But the rider allowed us to just track the actual costs associated with that investment rather than going through a general rate case. And what the settlement does is take that one step further, and that, in essence, the company is absorbing the need for that rate increase as long as we can maintain. If we have weather that's favorable to sales, we will be able to absorb the need for that rate increase for as long as possible. We'll look on that on a month-to-month basis. It's going to be, I think, very tight. And as I understand it, frankly, unless we have a really hot summer, there probably won't be refunds because we won't get to the 10.75. But who knows? If we have as hot a summer as we had as cold a winter, maybe there's an opportunity for some refunds at the end of the year, and we won't have any rate adjustment. So I think this is really a unique situation, and I think a lot of credit needs to go to Mr. Singer and Mr. Diller for kind of coming with some creative solutions here to something that I think is going to benefit the company because it's got that kind of fallback position in the event things don't go the way we would hope, that we've got the ability to come in and get that rate adjustment. At the same time, there's a benefit to the customers because the rate increase, if there is going to be one for Heskett 3, is delayed at least for a month and maybe longer, plus the opportunity in the event that sales are above what we expect to be, there's an opportunity for refunds. So I think this is, like I said, a very creative settlement agreement, and we appreciate the commission's attention. I think there was a lot of discussion around should it be demand related, energy related. At the end of the day, to the average customer, it's not going to make a difference. There's kind of a philosophical question there, but Mr. Diller did, I think, a great job of explaining it, even from my perspective, I think you really put a fine point on what we're trying to do here with the settlement in that regard. So we'd urge the Commission's favorable approval of the settlement agreement. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Norell?
Nothing else that hasn't been said other than, again, echoing Mr. Coons' sentiments to urge adoption of the settlement. So, thank you.
Ms. Jeff Kotsacko, any closing comments?
Nothing, just thanks.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Thank you, everybody, for your patience, even those of you who got tired of me. I'm sure you weren't the only one in the audience, Mike. No, I appreciate your time and your professionalism, your good information, everybody, staff as well. I think Mr. Diller hit on something that is really key in all of this, and that is that customers have an 88-megawatt resource at their disposal, and we know how important that is with all the demand out west, and I think that's something I haven't lost sight of in all this, and I really appreciate knowing the expansion capacity out at that site and the company's planning to accommodate for that down the road. So I think you've provided a lot of great answers to some tough questions, and I'm ready to move forward with this pretty quickly, depending on where my colleagues are, but we'll get a work session and make a decision soon.
Thank you, Commissioner Kolk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, everyone, for the time today. And it's funny because I was telling somebody I know from home the other day that depending when a person sits in a job, what opportunities come in front of you. In my time in the commission, we've had more wind farms and gas peakers and rate cases than ever in the five-year period, maybe ever, when Mike and I talk. And so I do appreciate the looking out of the box, because one thing that I've really talked a lot with my colleagues around the country and here is that the way of doing rate making is probably getting archaic with the way companies are now virtually integrated across different states and boundaries, and you got to have different ways to do things. So I really like the concept that's been put forward today. Quite honestly, I think the work sessions will probably go pretty quick. I just worry about the first move we make on something, making sure we've thought through all the other stuff. So I think that's the point of the work session, that I'll have a few questions. But in general, I think it's a very good idea. I do especially like the way that you've taken the ability with those gas lines and move that back to the gas resources, because that just the opportunity, I think, for all of us is the gas is going to be here. We're going to need it, and we've always got to build bigger. And I'm really glad that you made that 6-inch line to 10-inch line, because I remember that hearing as well. So that's really all that I had. Thank you. I do have a question for the general the attorneys in the group here, or the judge, is that tell me again how we noticed this as a hearing, but it was a hearing on the settlement agreement and how this all gets put back together. I'm just a little bit unclear how that might work on the legal side.
Ms. Jeff Kotsack, what do you want to address that?
I got the answer to that one.
Because while we're all here, let's make sure we're all in agreement.
You think about what the key to your notice is issues.
Okay.
If the issues are covered, you don't need another notice. If the issues are different, you do. And in this case, there are a couple different issues. The application got amended after the notice went out. Well, was asked to be amended. That requires commission approval to take out the pipeline. And the settlement changed the method of recovery to something that no one who read the notice would know exists, the fixed charge. And so I think on that basis, a very quick notice of opportunity is necessary.
Subject to the commission approving the settlement agreement you're talking about, if we end up having to, is that something that the first item of discussion for a work session?
Well, it's my recommendation that we just get it out as quickly as you want to get it out. I don't think you could make a decision on what you heard today about the settlement without that second notice.
Okay, I'll defer to the portfolio holder how you want to handle that. But, okay, if we're going to move quickly, we need to do that part.
It's not so much that you had a hearing about a settlement versus litigated case. It's what issues came up.
So I'm looking at the notice, and the notice talks about the increase in customer rates on a KW basis.
Right. Very simple. So we just quickly say there was a settlement, and it's about this, and we had the hearing, and see if anyone wants further.
Could you draft that up today, and we have a special meeting tomorrow?
Probably. Jerry could.
I don't know. That's
we could draft it fairly quickly.
Yeah, tomorrow morning.
Because we have work sessions in on budget or something tomorrow,
Which I'm going to be doing on the road. But I'll be here first thing in the morning. So,
Okay, well, that's. I just wanted to tighten that up, but thank you all.
Okay.
Just before we go off, sir, Mr. Kuntz or Mr. Norell, any comments on the notice issue from either of you?
No, we don't have any problems with the notice.
Any other matters from any of the parties before we go off the record?
No.
Okay, that closes the hearing. Thank you.
Thank you.